Welcome to the Society Podcast, brought to you by The Last Lions, where we feature stories of men seeking to impact society for the better. On today's show, we have with us Billy Kingus, who is the executive director of the Pope Francis Center in Detroit, Michigan. They are one of the leading organizations combating homelessness and its root causes in Detroit. We talk about homelessness and poverty, the role and importance of community, and Billy's own personal journey in working to build community throughout his life. Billy Kingus, welcome.
Hey, good to see you.
Good to see you. So let's start with what you do and who you are, and let's begin with that.
What do I do? That's a very good question. There's a lot of pieces of my life. Currently, I'm broadcasting live from my office in downtown Detroit, which will no longer be my office by the end of the day. We're in the midst of a move. I work with an agency called the Pope Francis Center, and we're at the cusp of a big change in terms of our organization. So in terms of what do I do on most days, I spend time in Detroit. And what I do here is there's an organization that I'm a part of called the Pope Francis Center, like I said, and they work to try to end chronic homelessness in the city. So the way that we've been going about doing that for our history up to this point is by trying to ensure that life-saving, life-preserving essentials are being provided for people who are experiencing homelessness. Twice a day we have meals, we've got laundry services, we've got showers, basic needs, clothing, a rotation of different clinics, and other things that come through our warming center, which is in the old St. Catherine's Chapel of a parish called Saints Peter and Paul in downtown Detroit. Now, a few years ago, we had begun to think about what would it look like for, and this is before I joined the organization, but they began to recognize that much of what was being done focused on putting a Band-Aid on existing problems, but doesn't get to the core of why is it that people are chronically homeless. Most people who experience homelessness, it's short-term, it's one time, but there's a population where there's a degree of chronicity to the homelessness that's experienced. And so we're on the cusp of launching a project that we're calling Bridge Housing. We've built a campus in a neighborhood of Detroit, a little bit further out from downtown, called Core City. And in that, there's going to be a bunch of wraparound services for people who are staying there temporarily. So it's a kind of a temporary housing solution. But much more than that, there will be an on-site medical, dental, clinic, behavioral health, care for overcoming addiction, job training, literacy, skills, things like that. So we got 40 units of residential with all those services built into it that we are gearing up to launch this summer. And so that's gearing up to launch that has been probably where most of my work energy is going. And then where most of my home energy is going goes to raising my 5 sons and trying to be a vibrant and helpful part of my faith community and my neighborhood. So that's what I do with my life.
Yeah, great. Yeah, that's a good overview. Yeah. So Billy, you talked about homelessness, and you used this phrase chronic homelessness, which I think to a lot of people that's new to them, or I think a lot of people, they have their images, stereotypes of the homeless. Can you maybe explain that more? Like, what is chronic homelessness, and maybe why do some people seem to be stuck in that place?
I want to be very careful of overgeneralizing.
Sure.
But chronic homelessness, in terms of what's the definition, it means basically people who have been homeless for either a long period of time, let's say 6 months to a year or longer, or have experienced peak bouts of homelessness. So they might find housing, but then lose it, find housing, but then lose it. And in many cases, folks who are have been on the streets for a long period of time, many of the guys that I see each morning have been on the street, not just for years, but in some cases for decades. And so for those folks, the solution isn't working. For many people, the systems that we have are working fine. People are able to find care, get into a place eventually, and it sticks. Or maybe they're able to rely on a social network to keep them their head above water during a period of homelessness where they're not necessarily living on the streets themselves, but might be couch surfing or living out of a car. But for our guys, the question of why isn't uniform.
Sure.
We could talk about, and you can approach this from a couple of different levels. One would be from a systemic perspective, what are the key factors in homelessness? And that, I think, is pretty straightforward. If you want to see the most effective way of addressing homelessness in a community, it's simply to ensure that there is a supply of affordable housing. That doesn't eliminate it altogether. And for these guys, a supply of affordable housing doesn't necessarily get to the core of what's going on with them.
Sure.
What we've identified as the root cause amongst causes is an inability to work past traumas. Now, that can express itself in a lot of different ways. And the traumas can come from a lot of different places. And in many cases, even if there was not existing trauma when someone became homeless, the experience of being homeless on the street can create traumas in someone's life that make it increasingly difficult to overcome. And what trauma can do is it can create any number of coping mechanisms, which could include things like addiction. They could exacerbate existing mental health conditions or even trigger new mental health conditions. It can create a lack of sustainable sleep and nutrition, which undercuts somebody's ability to thrive in their position. So some folks kind of get caught in a cycle. And so I don't want to say that any of these particular symptoms, like we sometimes would think about mental illness or addiction as the reason someone's on the street. But in most of those cases, that's maybe oversimplified view of it. There's many people who have addictions or who have mental illness who aren't on the street. And there are people on the streets that don't have mental illness or addictions. So I do think, however, maybe the most common underlying cause is some kind of significant trauma that they do need help with. So that's what we're trying to do with our bridge housing, is to create a place where the process of recovering from trauma can happen with the sort of wraparound services that can sustain long-term success in life.
Sure. Yeah, you spoke about trauma as perhaps the root cause here, which is really interesting because so many of us have undergone traumas. Everyone has in some respect, I mean, large or small, however you would characterize it. But for those who have gone through really serious trauma, what is it about that that might lead to homelessness? Because, right, there are people who have gone through very serious trauma and they're not homeless. And then there are those who end up homeless. Can you speak more about what's going on there, what might be going on there?
Well, there's always going to be like a very complicated web of circumstances. So imagine, you know, all of us are balancing in life in some way or another. And so one of the, I think maybe the most key factor, you could argue with this, is kind of the level of trauma you experience at a young age is one of the greatest social determinants of your long-term success, even if it's not homelessness. A huge amount of early trauma in somebody's life, by and large, is almost insurmountable to overcome without a lot of stuff. But let's say, you know, you are on a platform where, you know, you've got other stuff going for you. in spite of the trauma, you've got maybe a family that cares for you, or social capital that you're able to draw from. Maybe it's you've got access to education, nutrition. Another huge factor in long-term sustainability is having adequate nutrition, particularly in the first 1,000 days after a child's conceived until its second birthday. So there's all these different factors, and if enough of them aren't working, so that's why I want to be very careful to say with any of these things that there's a single uniform thing. There can be problems. And in the case of some folks, then they've learned how to deal with the anxiety, the trauma, the lack of trust, whatever expressions there are with what are fundamentally short-term solutions rather than long-term strategies. So that becomes a huge issue as well. That's another key indicator of flourishing, is one's ability to think long-term about life. If you're in a situation where part of your trauma means you really don't have any expectation of long-term success, or that there's no correlation between your efforts and the payoff. Maybe you're in a situation where, these are just hypotheticals, but you're in a situation where every time you get something, a parent takes it away from you because they're feeding their own addiction, or there's theft or violence in your community. Maybe many people that you know are dying at a young age. This disincentivizes the ability to think in terms of long-term consequences. And so for somebody who's been traumatized in those ways, it becomes increasingly attractive to focus on what can alleviate short-term anxiety and discomfort. And in many of those cases, something like drug abuse or alcohol abuse can become a more attractive solution. Plus, there's also genetic predispositions towards alcohol and things like that can play a role. It's a huge, that's why it's almost like, there's no macro pattern beyond just recognizing that, you know, there are ways that trauma can play out in the lives of the folks where they've become homeless, I mean, chronically homeless in particular. But at the root of most of the ways that people have tried to adapt, if you will, the sort of the tower or the house of cards, if you will, has been blown over by the traumas in their life. And those of us who have a house that's built on a much more sturdy foundation, where we have those kind of social supports, which are able to help us to guide ourselves through the storms of life and find safe harbor, it's a lot easier for those of us with that solid foundation. That's a long answer to basically say I don't know. In most cases, it's really
yeah. Can you speak maybe to the role of community? I think something you're touching on here is beyond personal trauma is the community around the individuals who have gone through this trauma and are, it would seem, on a trajectory to homelessness, you know, or they're finding different coping mechanisms. And can you just like speak to what healthy community looks like, how we work towards that? Yeah, how do we work towards healthy community?
Yeah, there's a lot of paradigms for community building that I think are really critical. And I've seen communities work variously well and variously poorly. Before I get into, you know, what makes a healthy community, I want to maybe, you know, touch on one of the pieces that you said, which is basically how do you build a healthy community? When I was a young man, maybe even a teenager, I ran into a work by a fellow named Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran pastor who was executed by the Nazis after his involvement in a failed assassination attempt on the Fuhrer. He's written some stuff that's really impacted me over the years, and one of them was a book on Christian community. And I'm going to say this quote not entirely accurately. It's going to be in English for one. But also, I'm probably not going to remember it completely. But he basically said, when trying to build a community, those who love their vision of a community will destroy it, but those who simply love will build community wherever they go. Mm-hmm. And I've reflected on that quite a bit over the last several decades of basically trying to build communities. It's, if there's a through line in terms of my whole life and career, I've been helping communities be grown and fostered in one form or another. And I've seen them thrive and I've seen them struggle. No community has ever been perfect. But one thing I have noticed is there's a huge temptation to begin a community with a vision of how it's supposed to be. And so before I talk about what's critical to community, I want to say we have to be careful about our natural utopian tendency in trying to solve this issue. Every community is going to be different. And as soon as you begin to hold on to your utopian tendency, there's a way that those who do not fit the vision become treated as outsiders, become treated as those who don't fit in, and social pressure rather than becoming a boon or something of cohesive value can actually become abusive in and of itself. It can become the source of trauma. This is one of the things I encountered a little bit, even in my PhD dissertation, where I was exploring the Word of God community, which you and I are both familiar with. And it was a community that was essentially built on some pretty utopian dreams. And for those who fit, it became a source of tremendous support and life. But there were cases of people who felt as if they had to subvert themselves or became explicitly ostracized from it as a result. And that's not to demonize that particular community in any sort of way, but just one that I'm most academically familiar with. And there's been, you know, countless examples in my own personal life of seeing this, whether it be at a parish or at a nonprofit or even at something as simple as a coffee shop. There are ways where our attempts to create community can be very good and have the highest of ideals. But if you lose that, that understanding that at its core, a community is not about the embodiment of ideals, but hopefully the expression of natural bonds of love and affection at its best, that's going to be key. So that's a big preface to the original question, which is, so how do you go about doing this? Well, you want to be in a place where people do love one another. And love is, in my experience, never something that's been done perfectly. I love my children, I love my wife, and they'd be the first to tell you that I'm my worst, the worst person I am is probably the person I am with them, right? So if you're in a situation where the people who are trying to love you the most are the most wounded people in your life, yeah, that can be really, 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 really traumatic. So I think the community that fails a lot of our guys first is maybe the family, the most basic of community. That's the place where we're supposed to have the, you know, we learn the lessons of love there. That's the school where we learn how to love and how to be loved. But then, of course, a broken family, even in a healthy community, has more support than a family that may be in a place where all the other constituent members might have their own dysfunction and woundedness or disconnectedness. These can be expressed a lot of different ways. I think we do, in some ways, we expect guys to be homeless to have come from places where, you know, everybody was, you know, poor. But actually, one of the things that's interesting is some of the guys that we see started out in pretty affluent communities. But they didn't fit within it. They experienced the ostracization there from their families or the dysfunction that's within it or whatever. So I do want to kind of say there's a lot of different ways that somebody might find themselves homeless. But in almost every case, there was a community that didn't love well that they were a part of. And that can be made worse by material poverty. But there's a kind of spiritual poverty that can be pervasive at every socioeconomic level, which can play a role in some people's lives. So I don't know if that's helpful in terms of addressing that question. But
Yeah. Well, you touched on poverty there, of course, which is, I mean, that's the other piece, if you will, that's in people's minds. They think of homelessness and, poverty, right? If you don't have a house, you're poor. And if you're poor, you're most likely to lose your house in some way. I mean, you're to become homeless or to barely hold on to one, you know, and that, and you touched on that, how even some affluent or, you know, people who've come from affluent communities have ended up homeless. You know, there's a lot of talk about, or certainly we hear it all the time, about personal responsibility, you know, and only oneself up by one's bootstrap, you know, that's, that's, and some people think, you know, that's basically the solution, or, you know, no matter where you came from, no matter what you've been through, you know, you got to take responsibility. You got to, you work hard, you can find a way, right? You can become, find a house, you can get a job, just go out, get a job, right? That's the, that's how a lot of people approach this, right? And you can become successful. And there, and there's, it's very American. Yeah. How do you address that?
So this is a an area I think it's worth being really maybe nuanced on that question, because it's not insignificant. Research that I've run into seems to bear out that amongst those other factors that I talked about in terms of long-term success, the ability to kind of forecast decisions for the future, things like that, another really, really significant factor in somebody's success is, do they position themselves with an internal or external locus of control? Somebody with a external locus of control believes that the world that they inhabit is the primary factor in terms of the life that they are living and the future that they will have. Whereas someone with an internal locus of control believes that they themselves are the principal agent in the direction of their lives. And having an internal locus of control has a tremendous impact on long-term success. I think that promoting or somehow helping people to do, to actually realize that their actions actually can be consequential is a part of helping somebody to heal long-term. Mm-hmm. However, I think that that very real fact can sometimes be used as an excuse to not understand, have empathy, or to really become involved with the very real world of obstacles and hindrances that are a part of somebody's life. There Sure. truly is no such thing as a self-made man. Mm-hmm. You can work very, very hard, but you're always standing on the shoulders of someone else. Right. Now, one of the keys of a internal locus of control is that you begin to realize that there are shoulders out there you can find to stand on. There are ways that you can begin to develop intentionally the kind of community that you want to be a part of. And our hope with Bridge Housing, to bring it back to Pope Francis, is that we can start to begin to establish some of those patterns. Because long term, yeah, if you only see yourself as victimized or victimizer in some cases, that's a very detrimental pattern of behavior.
Yeah.
But, you know, folks that are able to recognize that that changes, even small changes that they make to their life, can be compounded over time to create tremendous impact. That's mm-hmm. a really key mentality to shift. And that's, you know, I've been working within the social service world for a good chunk of time at this point, and some of the most amazing transformations that you see, they begin not with large efforts, but with small steps. In fact, I think most people can recognize in their own life, that's really the only way that any big change is made. I've taken several very large leaps in my life, but none of them took outside of the day-to-day choices that you make to sustain that effort, to basically inhabit the large choice that you've made. And so I come back to a quote from St. Teresa of Calcutta quite often, that there are no great things, there are only small things with great love. Mm. And I think that becomes the core of shifting our mentality around where is the locus of control in our life. And whatever bootstraps we're supposed to be pulling on, they're never our own. But sometimes we have a community that is able to help us supply it, and And we have a lot more control than sometimes we think about where are we getting our bootstraps from and who are we helping mm-hmm. us? Who are we surrounding ourselves with to help pull on them? But we don't ever want to. I think it's a dangerous delusion to believe that one pulls oneself up by their own bootstraps.
Right.
It's not to say hard work is not valuable. I work very hard, and I think that it's a virtue to apply oneself. But I have no delusions that somehow I got to where I am on my own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like what you're working towards at the Pope Francis Center, what you want to help people to do, to help them stand on their own in a sense, to empower them, but not to be alone, you know, within the context of community, of people who love them, you know, helping them to realize they are loved and they can love other people. I guess, what would you add to that? You
know? If we can figure out how to have community where people love and are loved, I think that's the key and that's the core.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to be very careful not to plan. This is a temptation that I have, and it's a temptation that I'm fighting even right now. It's very tempting to try to figure out where things are supposed to be. And I work with a guy, Father Tim McCabe, who has been at the center of much of what we've done. He's our president. And one of the things that he's constantly reminding me of is, we don't need to know. In fact, we shouldn't know all the details of where we're going because our guests are going to teach us. Part of what it means to love means to have a degree of maneuverability. We need to be agile in our ways of loving one another. So having a community that has enough space to adapt and to adjust, the recognition that a community is a living thing. Even the most kind of traditional communities that exist out there, they're very much alive. And if they're embodying tradition very well, they are growing and adapting as much as anybody else. There's a quote from Yaroslav Pelikan that I think about quite often, where he says that tradition is the living faith of the dead, but traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. And as you're developing community, there's a temptation for both tradition and traditionalism. Tradition is to really allow the wisdom of those who have come before, the lessons, the best practices, the research, you know, all of the various sources, if you will, to help inform what you're doing in a way where you are standing on the shoulders of as many giants as possible. But there is a way that you can be tempted to ossify. And so traditionalism is the way that sometimes history practices, way things have been done, can become stagnant within the context of maybe like a religious community. But within the context of an organization, often that ensconces itself in the forms of bureaucracy and things like that, creating systems that have too much weight to bear the requirements of agility that a community needs. And I think that both of those point to an underlying tendency within organizations to allow the lessons and the systems that we used to get us through a set of circumstances or difficulties to become calcified, like I said. Mm-hmm. And communities do need to be able to evaluate what's working and what's not working effectively, and to have enough grace to make mistakes with one another in love, but to keep growing and keep moving. There's another analogy that John Henry Newman used to talk about the development of Christian doctrine. I use a lot of these religious examples because I'm a theologian by training and things like that. But he in his essay on the development of Christian doctrine, he talks about that you know that a tree is alive because of the way it grows and moves and changes, in the same way that you know that, you know, the articulation of the faith is alive because it moves and grows and changes. You'd be actually worried if it didn't. And so as the environment changes within a community, you always had to ask the question, how are we being called to move and change, to adapt to the new reality that we're living in? Wherever there's light, like the tree, the plant needs to address its branches towards the light, or extend its roots to where the water is. It needs to change and grow. If there's an obstacle that's put in the way of its growth, it needs to learn to grow around it. And when you're dealing with people, it's an ever-changing environment. People are not only never permanent parts of a community. People come and they go. People are born and they die. But even those people who are within the community are experiencing their own shifts, changes, and evolutions in life. And so the things that may have worked within one moment of a community's life are going to, by small acts and great love, as Mother Teresa said, be shifting and growing the community so that it adapts to more fully embody the great ideal of selfless love that I think is at the core of what is good and true and beautiful in every vibrant community.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Billy, I guess shifting from community to you a little bit and your personal journey, I wonder if, well, I don't know, that involves community. I mean, it always does. But yeah, how did you become interested in this work, in, I mean, not just in working against homelessness, but in community and in your faith, and, you know, yeah, just.
There's a very many factors, as with all of our lives. We are a collage of influences that in each individual element is difficult to see. But I'll give you a broad strokes personal biography, with the caveat that I'm certainly eliminating many important pieces of it. I started getting involved with building community. I was born into a Christian community. I was born into a loving family. I mean, most of us are born into one community or another. But when I was in high school, it was maybe the first time that I attempted to build a community myself, if you will. And that was through the influence of some mutual friends that we have, some folks. We were involved with a group called Mission Christ. And very early on in my involvement there, I was encouraged by one of the leaders at the time to consider beginning a Bible club at my school. So when it's a Bible club, it's like an official extracurricular activity, like a sponsor or whatever. And we get together and we just do stuff. So we started to build a community. I went to a school in Ann Arbor, Michigan called Huron, and we created a group called Alpha Omega. And I was one of the early leaders of that group. And what I learned, really, because I didn't know what I was doing at all.
It does at that age, yeah.
But what really worked well, I think a lot of people in high school understand this, no matter what the community is community is not something that you build fundamentally through strategy, but through relationship, and that relationships are built with time, which is really frustrating. Fact, because you can't scale community very easily without scaling relationships and scaling time. And I only had 24 hours each day, and I've somehow managed to fill all of them every single day. So what I learned was that because I was in high school and I was spending my days with these people in classes and between classes and lunch, and we would gather before school oftentimes at the flagpole or in other places. And we would spend each morning. So we'd gather each morning, we'd pray, we'd spend each lunch together. We'd talk to each other in between classes. We'd gather after school. We'd do service projects together. We'd spend tremendous amounts of time both in school and out of school. And a very tight-knit community developed in spite of me being a total idiot about how one goes about doing it. So I learned a really early lesson, which is maybe the most important factor, is just that you spend time with people, that you give the relationship the time it needs to grow. So I did that for a number of years. I did graduate from high school, which meant that that community had to evolve without me at that point. And early on in my my college career, I felt that I wanted to give more to my faith. So I changed my major and institution. And first I was going to study computer science. Abandoned that early on when I felt called to go into Christian ministry as a career. I enrolled in a school called William Tyndale, where I was going to study youth ministry. That school folded while I was attending there. And so then I finished up my undergraduate degree at a place called Regent University, which was kind of interesting. I could finish the degree taking only online classes, which at the time was still a pretty new thing. And so I felt like I was kind of cheating the system. Never actually went to the campus. Finished up with some online classes. I took a semester where a good chunk of it I spent backpacking across Europe, going to internet cafes and finishing up my coursework, doing my own kind of version of a study abroad. But throughout all of this was kind of involved with doing some community stuff. I was involved with my church, I was working in the youth ministry there, was eventually brought in as the youth minister of a Lutheran church, was involved with, continued to be involved with the group Mission Christ, where I was leading for a number of years there, and was kind of leaning heavily into that church thing. Shortly after I graduated, I was a part of was part of a couple of church launches, one of which was a massive failure, and one of which was, I would call it potential success, although success is always somewhat predicated on other factors. So the first one we tried to form, a faith community, and I think the foundation of it was really good in terms of we had people who were already living in community. It was some of the people who we had connected with at Mission Christ, at some other areas. We decided, let's start a church. We're going to call it, and we called it unofficially. It was no official name at this time. We called it Holy Ghost Ninja Church. And that was because my friend John had always thought it would be funny to call the church Holy Ghost Ninja. And it was successful insofar as in the early days, we all had the freedom to spend a lot of time with one another. So the leadership team of that church, we would like go out and spend, you know, none of us were married yet, except for John. But we'd just go out and spend hours in the evenings, you know, talking, praying. My friend Josh, who had recently gotten married, would have us over every Wednesday, and we have, you know, dinner at his house with anybody we could bring along. Just kind of bring whoever you found that week along with you, and the church began to kind of grow based on who were you dragging to dinner, and we'd meet on Sundays. But it was pretty unstructured. It was just a bunch of us hanging out. Now, eventually, the church started to, our buddy Bill came back. He had been in Ireland doing some mission work. He came back and sort of took the helm of it and started to make it more church-like and less a bunch of people hanging out together-like. And at that point, I exited because I was already working at another church and was involved with some others. And it was too much to try to maintain a church plan and working several other jobs at the time. So that church did exist for a number of years beyond where I was at, but I think ultimately they didn't have the freedom to continue living kind of the radical relationship life that had early on helped it to sustain the small life that it had. Small life. So it doesn't exist anymore. Now, the other church that I started was with a guy called me up. His name was Sung, and he was the pastor of a small dying church in Ann Arbor. And he said, I have this vision for relaunching this church. And he was working on selling off their church building, and then they were going to use the money to seed the capital to start a new church. So I came on as a second employee of that and helped lead the kind of the worship elements as we relaunched what was the University Reformed Church, and it became known as Grace Ann Arbor. And so I helped get that church off the ground for its first year or so. And what I think ultimately worked there was their focus, and they continue to exist and now have, I think they're up to 4 sites now around Southeast Michigan. Lots of people are involved, but they took much more of a, an approach where they had a very targeted demographic, and they were trying to build a community that really helped meet the needs of that demographic. It was closer to maybe what Dietrich Bonhoeffer warns against, of loving one's vision of community, but in terms of its planning. But the thing that set it apart from maybe that is, rather than loving its vision of community, it was asking, how do we love these people? So it was looking at the people who are coming into Ann Arbor without a church home and asking the question, what do we do to love these folks? And responding to that rather than saying, here's what we need to do. And actually, Sun was really good at doing that. I think there was a few moments in our early days where I feel like I was tempted to love my vision of community because I had all these great ideas. I had seen churches working this way or that way, and I've studied this thing, and I had my ideals. And what Sun did pretty well was oftentimes he was very helpful at recognizing when it was my vision of community and not, you know, the vision that's going to help serve the particular population that they were reaching out to. So that was all happening. So that was my early experience with church. After about a year of helping get that off the ground, I then made a big change in my life and moved to Chicago to go to seminary, which I can talk to in a minute here. But I just wanted to maybe put a bookmark there because those were my early faith communities that I had been involved with. And those are some of the lessons that I learned. Relationship is built on time. And strategy needs to be built on love. I think those were some really key things. And simultaneously, all of this was happening, I was trying to supplement my income because ministry jobs aren't necessarily known for their lucrative salaries. So I started working at some cafes. I had been involved early on with launching, kind of scaling up this cafe called the Ugly Mug. And then I had started a church cafe called the Common Cup, which was in the basement of this Lutheran church. And in both of those cases, I learned another lesson about building community, which has stuck with me. Which is one of the best ways to communicate what you care about is to care about what other people are communicating. And in the backdrop of that is I was somewhat of a failed evangelist in my early in my late teens and early 20s. I would hang out with guys that would go out. And, you know, just we would be very adamant about, like, how do we share our Christian faith? And so we would, like, knock on doors or go down to the Diag and stand on milk crates or hand out Bible tracts or whatever. And this was kind of a very overt way of telling people, this is what I care about. And they don't care at all. They don't care at all about that.
Yeah.
I didn't have anybody ever stop and say, oh, thank you so much for this valuable information. But as I started to work at cafes, I really started to care a lot about what was happening in the lives of the people who would show up. And somebody shows up for a cup of coffee each day, and every day you're authentically interested in who they are and what they're doing. They begin to be interested in who you are and what you're doing. And there's some people who I met at those cafes that are still interested in who I am and what I'm doing. In fact, there's one guy who comes over to my house still to this day, every single week. And that all started just a few months into my, one of my cafe jobs where he was coming by and we just got to talking. So I learned that, you know, as you're trying to build relationships, because relationships are at the core of community, you have to be in environments where you A, encounter human beings, and then B, when you encounter them, it is really helpful to make the conversation grounded in authentic interest in who they are and what's happening to them, rather than some kind of a prefabricated agenda that you're trying to do. So those are a few of my early lessons in life. I don't know. Let's take a pause there, because that takes me through. I would say that was like my early adulthood experiences with that. Mm-hmm. Anything that we want to pause on with that or talk about?
Well, yeah, maybe you mentioned seminary, so wherever you want to go, it's totally up to you. But because I'm thinking of Cultivate right now with all the cafes. So if you want to go there, but if you want to go back to seminary, that.
All right. Well, let me give you a little context. Yeah. So I had been eager to start another community. So after my involvement with launching a couple of churches, I wanted to start another church. I thought, it would be really good. Maybe, who knows what it would have been. I never wound up doing that. I had a vision for trying to serve, instead of what we were doing with Grace, which was trying to invite in people who didn't have a church home, but by and large, they were people who maybe had a church background. So Ann Arbor is a city of a lot of transients, particularly with the student population.
Sure.
So a lot of people we were serving at our church were people of faith. But I thought, what would it look like to serve maybe people who didn't have a faith community background at all, who are from this community? I was kind of interested in working with indigenous population of Ann Arbor, if you will.
Yeah.
And so I had run into some issues with I had grown up in a denomination called the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. They're a conservative Lutheran body, part of a tradition called confessional Lutheranism, and they were really rooted in. I mean, their early history was rooted in opposition to a movement called Pietism, which was within Lutheranism. Mm-hmm. I hadn't had much involvement with Pietists, but I started running into some of them, and I was attracted to Pietism because of some of the ways that it was engaging in the world. I had become convicted through some of my years in ministry of the very important thing, which is love of one's neighbor. If you read the New Testament, the words of Jesus in particular, this theme of loving one's neighbor is really, really, really important. In fact, if you take the Gospel of Matthew seriously, there's a passage in the 25th chapter where Jesus, it's one of Matthew's promises of presence. Jesus promises that he will be present to us in the person who is hungry, in the person who is thirsty, who is sick, who is in need of accompaniment. And so we want to be people who are encountering Christ in these disguises, if you will. And in my years of doing youth ministry, I had taken some mission trips. One in particular had really struck me because I had gone down to Mexico and was involved with helping to build a church, strengthen a church that was located very much in the middle of just a slum. And one day while I was working, a fire started and it burned through and destroyed about half the community there. And I remember kneeling sort of in the waste and the garbage there and recognizing, like, there's a degree of suffering and poverty in the world which has almost been entirely foreign to me up to this point. Mm-hmm. And that if I wanted to experience the presence of God, I should go to a place where people are hurting. And I said a prayer there, which turned out to be one of the most dangerous prayers of my life, which was, Lord, I want to give my life to serve those who are hurting like this, to take whatever wealth, privilege, position that I've got and to invite it into the holy work of love. So I had been looking for that. I had not found it perfectly in the church I had begun, but some of the work that had been done by the Pietists in the United States attracted me. There's in particular a denomination called the Evangelical Covenant Church, which I found to be really inspirational in a lot of how they lived out their faith. They were kind of Lutheranism light and had some really interesting, diverse congregations that I had encountered both in Chicago, Detroit, and around the United States. So I called up their denominational regional headquarters, scheduled a meeting with their guy, and I showed up and said, I would like to plant a church in this denomination. And he's like, are you part of the denomination? I was like, no. He's like, do you have any seminary education? And I said, no. And he said, well, then the answer is no.
Yeah.
So he encouraged me, though, to say, if you're serious about this, consider a seminary education. And so I did. I took my wife. I've been recently married, and we moved to Chicago so that I might be a seminarian in the Evangelical Covenant Church, which is a Protestant denomination. And, you know, it's actually very interesting. My first few weeks there, I moved before my wife did, and I lived with an intentional community there called the Jesus People USA, where they had built, they had bought like a big apartment complex or hotel or something, and had been living there for, you know, I don't know, a couple of decades all together as community. So that was another interesting view of community, which they were really cool. They were part of the denomination. Their community was a church within the denomination, and they were located in Chicago in a place where they were actively serving those in need out of their cafeteria each day, and you know, doing cool stuff. They had built a little cafe and skate shop at the base of it, and a little chapel service. And they had it was an interesting little view of another kind of intentional community. I had grown up around intentional community, but this is a kind of a different way of doing it. Kind of the Jesus People movements. There's a few. You know, I don't have time to get into the whole history of the Jesus People movement, but they were a cool alcove of what community looked like as some of those idealists were trying to live it out. But that, I digress. I went to seminary, was involved with some churches and stuff out there, but so I, as I was completing my seminary education, actually throughout the whole thing, a very annoying thing happened, which was I became very convicted that I needed to become a Catholic. So that's a whole, you know, a whole other journey. And viewers or listeners can look up that whole story if they'd like. I've done a couple of episodes just on that journey on a television program called The Journey Home. So people can look that up if they'd like. But at its core, when it comes down to kind of this question of community, I was really inspired by the way that the Catholics had thought deeply together about the care of their neighbor, and had gathered together each week around the sacraments, the Eucharist, and had sustained essentially this amazing community in spite of a lot of really dark and broken times over the course of 2,000 years, which is that's a pretty good track record as far as any community that I'm aware of. So I blew up my life, became Catholic, moved to D.C., to pursue a PhD in liturgy and sacramental theology. And then did a lot of work there, including I was a lobbyist for a short period of time, doing work trying to bring together policymakers and you know, the faith community to end hunger at an organization called Bread for the World. And so I was their national Catholic fellow. I was kind of in charge of bringing the Catholics to the table. And then at the end of that year-long fellowship, I got a call from a guy named Ryan who wanted to start a coffee and tap house. He had been working at Grace Ann Arbor, that church I had started with Sung the years before, and had heard about me and my work with coffee shops and such. So he convinced me to move back to Michigan, and we launched a nonprofit associated with a coffee and tap house that was called Cultivate, which I ran for a few years. And that was a whole nother vision of community. Like you had mentioned before, you were thinking about that. And that was my attempt to take some of the lessons that I had learned from starting churches and starting cafes and and apply them to a context which was very much based on the patterns of relationship, not the orders of belief. So we did, you know, we weren't trying to create a like a particular. We did have a mission. Our mission was to support the local food security safety net. And the reason I chose that is I wanted to choose a mission where it was something that drew people together more than drove them apart.
Yeah.
Right. If I said I'm going to create a mission where our goal is to make, you know, birth control more accessible. Okay, that would like that would divide people. If I was, our mission is to ensure that a strict adherence to the traditional formulation of the Constitution is the rule of the land. That would have, you know, been contentious. But when you say, okay, we're not going to clearly define our strategy on this, but what we're going to say is when we do stuff together, the thing we'd like to do is support ensuring that people have access to food. I think nobody's like, people should starve. Now, the strategies that we use, the approaches that can get there, people can disagree on. But yeah. I think by and large, there are a few outsiders, but by and large, nobody's going to be ostracized by a mission to end hunger. Mm-hmm. So that's what we try to build around. And that was another interesting life lesson, I would say. It's one of the things I learned from Cultivate. Is I was trying to build it around a common shared cause. And it did not energize people around that shared cause. But it did help to protect it from becoming about other things. And so so somebody might come in and want to do a fundraiser for X, Y, or Z. Hmm. And we could say, hey, if it's not directly related to supporting efforts to reduce hunger in our community, we're not going to officially sponsor that. And so limiting the scope of what you do helps to focus the community and make it actually a safer space. So that is an interesting thing. Like, there's a lot of talk about creating safe spaces in our world today. Hmm. And what I found is most efforts to increase the boundaries of what safe is ultimately alienate other people. Like, right. No matter how you draw the exterior bound of what safe is, you're going to have some difficulty because one person or another is going to be excluded. But if you have a limited center of gravity and never try to explicitly create a, you know, safe space for X community or Y community or the other, most people find that they can inhabit that space and feel like they have something to contribute. And so rather than defining community around avoiding what is uncomfortable, building a community around what inspires and what unites us seems to be more effective in my experience. So that's one of the lessons I learned from Cultivate. As well as, so the hunger issue was a good safeguard, but then the thing that really drew people together was our other two values. So we had craft, community, and cause. The fact that we served very good quality beer, very good quality coffee, and had really fun community events in the space made it a very vibrant space, at least in the time I was there. In Ypsilanti, Michigan. The space no longer exists, unfortunately. After I left about 6.5-7 years ago. I think it was a little over six years ago. My co-founders, Ryan and Becca, kept it going for a few more years. The pandemic plus some of their own personal issues caused them to sell it, and then the people who bought it after them had their own personal issues, which caused them to shutter it. And so Cultivate as an institution no longer exists, although it has reopened with one of our early volunteers actually taking the helm and opening it up as a place called Vertex. You can talk to Kara, who runs Vertex, about which lessons of community she's learning. I imagine they're on their own journey there, but it's no longer something that exists. And it's a little bit sad, but I'm glad that it's kind of been reborn, if you will, into a new thing. I went there just this weekend and had an iced Americano, which was delightful. So that was my journey to Cultivate. And then, yeah, for the last 6 years after that, I worked at Hope Clinic, where I was learning how to do the community thing in the direct service piece of serving one's neighbor, which was the job I had worked before I moved over to Pope Francis Center.
Okay.
And, Hope Clinic was an amazing place to learn about a ton of stuff, but we could pause at this point just because
we're
flying pretty interestingly through all this stuff.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on any of this stuff, Rob?
So, yeah, Billy, there's a lot here. Community runs through it all. And there's so much value in the work of building community. It's very hard, as all worthwhile things are that involve human beings, and we're imperfect, and yet we're all basically trying to love, and we all want to be loved, I hope that for people listening to this, they can reflect more deeply on this thing called community, which we all have. I mean, we're all born into, and we're all trying to build in some way, and we all want to belong, essentially. So our time is drawing to an end here, but I guess just any closing thoughts from you on, especially for those who are longing for more community in their lives, to be part of a community, you know, whether that's a church or just in their neighborhood or whatever that looks like, who are wanting to build more intentional communities, whatever that looks like. What would you say to those people? I think, kind of sum things up here.
Look at your calendar. Your calendar is going to tell you where you can build community or where you can't build community. Communities are built on relationship. Relationship is built on time. So that's one key thing. But if you spend time that's focused on yourself and what other people can give you, you're not going to be building community very much. So focus on small things, mm-hmm. great love, and surround yourself with the people that you want to make your community a part of. You're going to find that the community that you form is going to be based on the people who form it with you. So develop, I would say, if you're going to come up with a plan, it's love well the people you want to have in your life. And that can take a lot of different forms. I've seen it in coffee shops, online groups, book clubs. I've seen it in places and neighborhoods. But there's no way of getting around those fundamental things of time well spent loving one another.
Mm-hmm.
So figure out how you want to do that. There's no secret to it other than that. Like I said, some of the most powerful communities I've helped form were done when I was most stupid about it. Mm-hmm. But I put the time in and I care.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. And for those interested in Pope Francis Center and the work you're doing, who might want to be involved in some way, help, how can they learn more, get in touch?
Yeah. You can go to pfc.org. pfc.org, that's for PopeFrancisCenter.org. You could also go to PopeFrancisCenter.org, but yeah. PFC is a laser.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're trying to build a community here. We do have a community. That's actually one of the key things that makes me excited about this bridge project is we're inviting people who I spend every morning with.
Hmm.
You know, we've got breakfast with a lot of these guys that are coming into the place and lunch, and you're spending time together, which means there's enough trust that hopefully some of those walls that have been built as a means of resilience against the traumas and the bludgeoning of life's tragedies can come down. And with a lot of our guys, that's the work of years. And thankfully we've got years with some of these folks of building that trust. So, I encourage you all, come volunteer with us some morning, see life in action. You can sign up at pfc.org for a volunteer shift.
Okay.
Or just keep us on your radar if you're a person who prays. I would love your prayers, too.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, Billy Kangas, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, glad to be on the show. Thank you. Hopefully it'll be some positive impact in the world.
I hope so. All right. Thank you, Billy.